That day I told her,
I don't know, your father's going to be busy. She said, but I won't get in his way.
And I had glanced at Arturo, who was across the room pulling his boots on, asking him with my eyes what he wanted me to tell her. He stood and said,
you could come with us to Alma, if you're worried about it.
Yes, Maribel said, you come too.
It will be like the old days. Remember when you used to come, sitting there in your dresses?
You wore dresses? Maribel asked, surprised.
She used to try to look nice for me, Arturo said. She was almost as pretty as you are now.
Almost, I said,
and when he laughed, at last I gave in.
The building was simple. Walls built from mud bricks and straw, a roof made of wood beams and clay. There were plans for a swinging louvered door at the front that the men hadn't yet installed. The roof was nearly complete, although Arturo pointed out a few areas where sunlight filtered through, which needed to be patched. That's what he was working on that day. He climbed a ladder that was leaning against the overhang and settled himself onto the roof with a bucket of clay and a trowel he used to spread it. Maribel hurried around, handing things to the men when they asked for something, smiling at me giddily as she trotted from spot to spot. She hammered a row of nails into a board. She sanded around the latch on the door. She rinsed out the towels in plastic buckets of water. I stood off to the side, watching her and Arturo, and when I thought it wouldn't distract them, speaking occasionally to the men on the crew, some of whom had been at our wedding and some of whom had been at the hospital the day Maribel was born. The air was still damp from rain the night before, but the sun had burned through the haze of the morning and shone brilliantly in the sky. One of the workers, a husky man named Luis, gave Maribel his hat when he saw that she didn't have one. She laughed.
It's too big on me, she said, letting the brim fall to her cheeks.
Oh, come on. You look preciosa, Luis told her.
Arturo was on his knees on the roof. He was pulling clay out of the bucket with his hands and slapping it into the crevices between slats of wood. He was smoothing it with his iron trowel. And then he ran low on clay. Maribel was just below him, talking with Luis.
Luis, Arturo yelled, I'm going to need another bucket of clay soon.
Luis nodded, and Arturo turned back to what he was doing.
I'll get it, Maribel told Luis.
Do you know where it is? Luis asked.
Of course, Maribel said,
and ran off to find another bucket. When she returned, Luis offered to take it from her.
It's so heavy, he protested.
Maribel grinned.
I'm so strong, she replied. Do you have it? Arturo yelled down.
I got it, papi, Maribel said.
It's heavy, Arturo said. She's strong, Luis yelled up, and Maribel and I laughed. Let Luis bring it up, Arturo said, and turned his back again, smoothing clay. Maribel pouted.
Her whole life, I had watched her climb trees and scale stone walls in the courtyards in town with ease. Arturo usually frowned when she did those things. They didn't fit the Mexican conception of what girls could and should do. But I loved that about Maribel. The way she was unconcerned with trying to be like everyone else. She and Arturo were similar in that, although he didn't seem to recognize it.
Can I take it up?
Maribel asked me.
Let me, Luis said, reaching for the bucket.
But Maribel moved it away from him. She looked at me again with her big, expectant eyes. I never could resist her.
Go ahead, I said.
I stood at the bottom to hold the ladder secure.
Cuidado, Luis cautioned as she started climbing.
When she reached the top, Maribel shoved the bucket onto the roof.
Here you go, she said.
Arturo turned.
I thought I told you to let Luis bring it up.
Mama said I could do it.
Alma, Arturo shouted down. She shouldn't be up here.
She wanted to surprise you, I shouted back.
Arturo walked like a crab over to the bucket, careful to keep his footing on the slanted roof.
I'm stronger than you think, papi, Maribel said.
From the ground, I watched her hold one arm out and make a muscle. Such a small muscle, like a torta roll. Finally, Arturo softened and laughed.
Superwoman, he said.
Come back down now, hija, I said.
Are you holding the ladder? Arturo shouted.
I've got it.
Go on down, I heard Arturo say.
And so she started. One rung, two, then a noise. Something clattered off to the side. I startled and turned. I must have jerked the ladder. It slid in the mud on the ground from the rain the night before. And when I turned back again, it was as if the world was unspooling in slow motion. I saw Maribel's body tilt backwards. She let out a sharp scream. She reached her hand for the ladder, but her fingertips only grazed the rung. Arturo yelled. Maribel dropped 2 stories to the ground below. Her body smacked against the mud, sending it splattering into the air, all over me, all over Luis. Her neck snapped back. Her eyes closed. Luis got to her first. Arturo scrambled down the ladder, jumping off when he was halfway down. Maribel! He was shouting. Maribel! I stood in shock, blood frozen in my veins. Don't touch her, Luis said. But Arturo didn't listen. He held his hand under Maribel's nose to make sure she was breathing, then picked her up, her body limp as a rag doll. Her head rolled back over one of his arms. Her legs hung over the other and said her name over and over and over again as if it was the only word he knew. She didn't wake up. The other men on the side started running over, asking what had happened, offering to help. Without a word, Arturo cut through them all, cradling Maribel, trying to keep her still, walking quickly toward the truck while I hurried behind them, afraid to look, afraid to know what I already knew. There was no discussion. Luis got on the driver's side while Arturo climbed in the back with Maribel, holding her across his lap. I sat in the front, staring out the window, my eyes unfocused, my palms sweaty, my breath catching in my throat. At the hospital, Luis jumped out of the truck and came back not a minute later with a nurse, who took one look at Maribel and called for a gurney. We have to take her away now, the nurse said. She was stocky and firm. We'll go with her, I said. The nurse shook her head, and when someone else arrived with the gurney, Arturo laid Maribel down on it. As they started to wheel her away, I tried to follow. Arturo put his hand on my arm. Let them do what they need to do, he said. We sat in the waiting area, a small room with a cluster of wooden chairs. Arturo had sent Luis back to the job site. I trained my gaze on the floor, squeezing my hands. Once, I dared to look at Arturo. He had a wild, frantic look in his eyes. He saw me looking at him. What happened? He asked. I don't know, I said. She fell. But what happened to the ladder, Alma? I don't know. You were supposed to be holding it. I was! Then how did she fall? It must have slipped. You were supposed to be holding it, Arturo repeated. I turned around just for a second. Why did you even let her go up there? It wasn't safe. I thought she would be fine. But I told you. I know. And now she's not fine. I'm sorry, I murmured. The combined weight of horror and reproach pressing against my chest. Arturo leaned forward, propping his elbows on his knees, burying his face in his hands. I stared at the curve of his back and tried to remember. I'd had my hands around the ladder, and I had turned. Had I really let it slip? Was it my fault? Arturo had said as much, hadn't he? My fault, I thought. My fault. Repeating it in my head again and again. We waited and waited. Until finally the doctor emerged from the bowels of the hospital and told us. A bruised tailbone, 2 broken ribs, minor injuries except for 1. Her brain. Because of the way her head snapped back against the ground, the way it had snapped back up again and down 1 more time, her brain had been shaken inside her skull. The brain is very tender, the doctor said. When it shakes like that, it can tear against a small piece of bone in the skull that acts as a ridge. It's called shearing. That's what happened here. And now her brain is swelling. We can't let it keep swelling. There's only so much room inside the human head. If it swells too much, well... He looked at us both. He was an old man with a bushy mustache. She might not survive, he said. At the moment those words came out, someone, some spirit somewhere, snatched the air from my lungs. The doctor went on. She's intubated and on a ventilator. We gave her drugs to relieve the pressure, but they haven't helped in the way we hoped they would. So now what we need to do, what I need your permission to do, is remove a small piece of her skull to make room for the swelling and to keep the pressure from building too much. He stopped and looked at us again. If it builds too much, she could die. And the longer we wait to relieve it, the more damage she'll likely experience. Neither Arturo nor I said anything. We were holding hands, gripping each other's fingers as if strength could be found there. It's the only option, the doctor said. They opened her head. They removed a piece of our daughter. And when it was over, we realized that in that piece had been everything. Until then, I had believed that a person inhabited his or her whole body. I had believed that a person's essence was spread throughout them. Who could think that a person's entire being is housed in a finger or in a hip bone or in a small piece of a skull, and that the rest of the body exists for appearances only? But Maribel changed so completely after the surgery. What else could I believe? Of course, I knew better. Medically, scientifically, they had explained everything to us. It wasn't the surgery that stole her from us. It was the accident. The moment her head snapped and bounced up and fell back again, her brain, like a mass of jello, slid inside her skull. Forward and back. And it tore against bone. And when it tore, it destroyed some of the connections between neurons, which was a word the doctor had to explain to us. And then there was the swelling, which second by second was only making everything worse. No, the surgery wasn't the thing that took her from us. It was the thing that supposedly saved her. Maribel stayed in the hospital for weeks. She regained consciousness shortly after the surgery and woke agitated and confused. With a tube in her throat, she couldn't speak. She looked hysterically at us, asking with her eyes where she was and what had happened. We explained everything. We explained it and told her we loved her, until she calmed down. Most nights we slept on a blanket on the floor of her hospital room. When we slept at home, we trembled and huddled against each other in our bed in the dark. Many times we cried. My parents came over and cried with us. Our friends came and wrapped their arms around us. I woke up every morning and knelt on the floor praying to God to heal her. I might have questioned God, I suppose, about how he could have allowed such a thing to happen, except that it didn't just happen. It wasn't an earthquake or a gust of wind that knocked her to the ground. It was me. I believed that completely by then. So I prayed for forgiveness and for God to bring her back to us. I wanted Maribel to grow up and get married and have children and friends and find meaning in her life. I wanted to see her graduate from high school. And I wanted to see how shy she would become when she introduced us to the man she had fallen in love with, the man that one day Arturo and I would welcome to our family. I wanted to sew yellow, blue, and red ribbons into her wedding lingerie for good luck. I wanted to see her grow round with a child and hold that child in her arms. I wanted her to stop by the house for meals and laugh at the television and rub her eyes when she was tired after a long day, and hug me when it was time to leave again, her husband waiting in the car, her child's hand in hers. I wanted her to have the full, long life that every parent promises his or her child by the simple act of bringing that child into the world. The implicit promise, I thought. I said every prayer I knew. After the surgery, a therapist came to Maribel's room and administered tests to make sure she could move, to make sure she could understand basic instructions, to make sure that her brain could still tell the rest of her body what to do. The doctor was pleased. She had a brain injury, but it could have been much, much worse. We began to hope. Would she come back to us, our Maribel? The Maribel we had known for nearly 15 years. They said perhaps, in time. But more likely, there would be something about her that remained permanently changed. They couldn't say for sure. Every brain injury patient was different. We heard that too often. It began to sound like an excuse for ignorance. It made me want to scream. What do you know? After weeks of rehabilitation, after working with a psychologist and a speech-language pathologist and the doctor, all they could tell us was things like, she struggles with finding the right words sometimes, and that will likely persist. Her short-term memory is erratic at best. Her emotional affect is flat, which may or may not change. She has trouble organizing her thoughts and her actions. She gets easily fatigued. She might be more prone to depression, even long-term. But she's young, which gives her a better chance at recovery. Besides, they all said, the brain is a remarkable organ. With the right attention and exercise, it can heal. Neither Arturo nor I knew what that meant. We thought, we'll be gentle with her. We'll be patient. And when she was released from the hospital, we sent her back to school with the idea that a learning environment was exactly what she needed. Get her using her mind again, we both thought. That would be good. But day after day, Maribel came home frustrated and depressed. The teachers talk too fast, she said. She spent hours in the nurse's office complaining of headaches. Even when the teachers tried to be accommodating, giving her extra time to take tests, repeating things for her benefit, it was of little help. After 2 weeks, we went back to the doctor at the hospital and asked for advice. He told us that if we could find her the right kind of school, a school with a strong special education program, it would help immensely. There were a few in Mexico City, he said, but the best were in the United States, if we were willing to go. He gave us a list of schools that he knew, schools with good reputations. Which one we chose was just a matter of where Arturo could find work. I said, but why didn't they tell us that earlier? The United States, Arturo said. You can get a job there, can't you? I was energized now that a solution was within sight. But this is our home, Arturo said. It's always been our home. It would only be temporary. He furrowed his brow in his particular way. Why are you so sure she can't get what she needs here? Qué vergüenza, Arturo. I'll take her there myself if you won't go. It's just so much has changed already. We've been through so much. So it's just one more thing? I don't know if she can handle one more thing. Well, she can't stay here doing this. Don't you want her to get better? Of course. Then? He nodded. But when I looked at him, I understood. He was the one who wasn't sure he could handle one more thing. We have to do this, I said. All I need is for you to say yes. And I promise I'll take care of everything after that. You won't have to worry about anything. I want to do what's best for her, Arturo said. I know. This is it. And finally, Arturo agreed. And the decision was made.
Mayor. What can I say? She grew on me. Those Sundays after church, instead of sitting on the couch with our parents, Maribel and I started hanging out in the kitchen by ourselves. She wasn't always good at keeping up a conversation. She lost her train of thought sometimes, and she talked slow in order to find the right words as she went along. And sometimes she forgot that we'd already discussed something, so I had to repeat myself. But a lot of the things she said were smart. Besides, I had learned that she was listening even when it seemed like she wasn't. When I had met her in the Dollar Tree, before I knew anything about her, she had seemed intimidating and aloof. But now that I knew better, I understood not to take it personally. She would trace her fingernails along the top of the kitchen table or look at the ceiling sometimes. But when I stopped talking, she would respond in a way that proved she'd been paying attention all along. And even better, that she was actually interested in what I'd said. Which is more than I could say for most people, and definitely more than I could say for any girl I'd ever known. My dad didn't like it.
Why can't you talk to normal girls? He asked me once, after the Riveras left.
What is that supposed to mean? My mom said. But we all knew what he meant. Why couldn't I talk to a girl that wasn't brain damaged? I did talk to the so-called normal girls, of course. I mean, I asked them to pass me a paper in class, or I mumbled an apology when I bumped into one of them in the hall. But it was never easy for me, at least not the way it was easy for me with Maribel. Maybe because she was brain damaged. Maybe because she didn't seem so intimidating because of that. In another life, one before whatever had happened to her had happened, I was pretty sure she would have been just another girl I was scared of. And I was pretty sure, too, that she wouldn't have given me the time of day. I had a feeling she'd been one of the popular girls, the one all the guys lusted over. But this was a different life, one where I was getting a chance with her. Maybe it was terrible to think of it like that, but I wasn't going to pass it up.
Do you remember that girl Enrique used to date? My dad went on. What was her name? Sandra. The one who wore headbands. You can't find someone like that.
I don't want someone like that, I said.
Leave him alone, my mom chimed. Maribel's a nice girl.
Maybe, my dad conceded, but not for Mayor.
My dad's narrow-mindedness only made me feel more connected to Maribel, though. Like maybe I was the only one who understood her, the only one who was willing to give her a chance. I started stopping by her apartment sometimes after school. Her mom wouldn't let Maribel actually go anywhere with me, so she and I just sat on the floor in the bedroom she shared with her parents and talked. They had clothes folded in piles along the wall and a mattress wedged into the corner. Maribel had a sleeping bag that she rolled up during the day and set under the window. But the atmosphere was uninspiring, to say the least, and I found myself wishing that I could take her somewhere, even just to Dunkin' Donuts down the street, where I knew we could score free donuts if they were about to throw them out anyway, or maybe to the movie theater, where I could show her how to sneak in the side door, which William and I had been doing forever. I thought she deserved it, you know? Getting out into the world. As far as I knew, she only went to school and came straight home, which made her seem a little like a caged bird who no one trusted to fly. But her mom wouldn't budge. The rule was that if I wanted to see Maribel, it had to be at either her apartment or mine. No going outside, no taking a walk, no nothing. Most of the time, I found her sitting on the bedroom floor, writing in her notebook or standing and staring out the back window. I'd ask her what she was looking at or what she was writing about. Sometimes she told me. Other times she didn't. Either way, it didn't matter much to me. I was aware that my original reason for talking to Maribel, which had been fueled by a sense of responsibility, had been replaced by something else. I just wanted to be around her. I still wanted to take care of her in certain ways, but it was more than that now. I liked her. I liked her more than I'd ever liked anyone. We talked about nothing, mostly. Like what she was doing in school and about music and our parents. I would tell her the most random things. Did you know that the average person drinks 16,000 gallons of water by the time they die? Or about the time I saw Vicente Fox on TV, and she would smile sometimes, which was always my goal. We talked about the weather, because now that it was getting colder, she was waiting for it to snow, to see what it was like. I guess there's no snow in Mexico, huh? I said.
Yes.
Yes, there's no snow, or yes, there is snow?
There is snow.
In Mexico? No way.
In the north, yes, she said.
You know, there's different kinds of snow, right? There's wet snow, which can get crusty and freeze, and then there's really light snow, which is soft. And don't even get me started on snowflakes. There are four classes of those: columns, dendrites, needles, and rind snow. She pulled out her notebook.
Say it again.
I did, and she wrote it down. You liked that? I asked. She nodded. Can I see? I held out my hand. Without hesitation, she gave me her notebook. On the page that was open, she'd written,
"Wet snow is hard. Light snow is soft."
Her handwriting was small and tight, and she pushed down so hard with the black pen she was using that she made indents on the paper. Everything was centered, one line at a time, down the middle of the page. At the top, way up in the margin, she had written her name and address. I kept reading. "Close the door behind you. Mrs. Pacer is room 310. My room is 312. How much does the bus ride cost? What is the name of the bus driver? Look at the bus driver's badge. Crystal. The school bus is free. The city bus is not free." I flipped back a few pages and read, "This is Newark, Delaware. Delaware is 3,333 kilometers from home. I feel the same today as I did yesterday. I handed the notebook back to her.
What happened? I asked.
What? Was it a car accident?
When?
Sorry, I mean what happened to you?
I fell. I was on...
She stopped.
It's long.
It's a long story?
She shook her head. A long thing of wood.
I racked my brain. A bat? I hated it when I didn't know what she was getting at. I wanted to show her that I could follow her. I wanted to be the one person that it was easy for her to talk to.
A ladder,
she said finally.
Oh, a long thing made out of wood, right. You were up on a ladder?
I broke two, she held up two fingers, of my ribs.
And you hit your head?
She lifted a flap of hair and showed me a scar, pink and waxy, like a gummy worm, behind her ear.
Does it still hurt now?
Like, can you sleep on it?
I get headaches.
So that's what the sunglasses are for?
Yes.
Do you even remember it?
I was on the...
ladder, I filled in. She nodded.
And then I was in the hospital. I don't know where I went in between.
Well, someone must have taken you to the hospital.
I mean, I lost myself in between.
Oh, I said. And then I just sat there. Because something about that idea, that you could be one person in one moment, and then wake up and be completely different, punched me in the gut.
You don't ask me how I'm feeling, Maribel said. I hate it when people ask me that.
She told me that before, but I didn't point it out. I just said, it probably gets old, huh?
I want to be like everybody else.
Yeah, I said, because I knew just what she meant. I'd spent my whole life feeling like that. Like everybody else was onto something that I couldn't seem to find, that I didn't even know existed. I wanted to figure it out, the secret to having the easy life that everyone else seemed to have, where they fit in and were good at everything they tried. Year after year, I waited for it all to fall into place. Every September, I told myself, this year will be different. But year after year, it was all just the same. I didn't say anything in response to Maribel that day. We moved on to another topic. But later that night, when I was lying in bed, I realized what I should have said. Because for her, at least, it would have been the truth. You shouldn't want to be like everybody else. Then you wouldn't be like you. One day, I walked back from her place to find my dad sitting on the couch, watching television. He had his sweat-socked feet up on the coffee table and a bottle of beer in his hand. Usually he didn't get home until later, so both of us were surprised to see each other.
What are you doing here? I asked.
He sat up, startled.
The diner closed early today. Not enough customers in the afternoons anymore. Aren't you supposed to be at soccer?
I tensed.
I was, I said. You're not wearing your soccer clothes.
Yeah. I scrambled through excuses in my head. My clothes were dirty, so I borrowed someone else's stuff.
This is someone else's? This? What you're wearing?
Well, I had to give it back after practice, so I changed into my regular clothes again.
You gave dirty clothes back to someone?
I nodded.
Who?
I said the first name I could think of. Jamal Blair. My dad pushed out his lips. He was sitting on the couch, twisted to look at me.
I never heard that name.
He's good. He's a midfielder. My dad squinted like he was studying me with X-ray vision. I tried to stand as still as possible.
When's the next game?
He asked, like he was testing me. I need to check, I said.
You don't know?
I didn't say anything.
You don't know?
My dad asked again, his voice booming this time. This was how things went with him. One minute you were having a conversation, and the next minute he was blowing up. There had been one other time that my dad had mentioned wanting to go to a game, but the fact that his work schedule wouldn't allow it had saved me. It was basically the only thing that had been saving me all along. By the time he came home each day, I just said I'd be at soccer, and he didn't know the difference. But it was over now, I thought. He'd finally seen through me. My dad raised his beer bottle and angled it toward the light.
Gone,
he muttered. He held the bottle over the back of the couch.
Get me another.
From where I stood, I could see four empties lined up next to the sink in the kitchen. I took the bottle, and my dad slumped back down in the couch cushions.
Was that it? Were we done now?
Then from the couch, my dad yelled,
Celia!
I heard my mom's footsteps move through their bedroom and down the hall.
Are you calling me? You can't keep up with the laundry?
She walked into the living room, shaking her head.
What are you talking about? By your soccer clothes. He says they're in the laundry.
My mom looked at me, confused. I just stared at her, trying to look as innocent as possible. But then her face changed, and for a split second I thought that maybe she had figured it out. But if she had, she didn't give me away. Instead, she said,
Sorry, I'll do laundry today.
Carajo,
my dad said, and that was the end of that.
Quisqueya Solís. Where should I begin? Venezuela is where I was born and where I lived until I was 12 years old. I was a very beautiful child, happy in every way. But when I was 12, my mother fell in love with a man from California. He asked her to marry him, so we moved to his home in Long Beach. It was an enormous house with a pool in the courtyard. I believe a famous architect had designed it. Hollywood studios called us sometimes to see about using the house in a movie or for a commercial shoot. It was very glamorous. I was content there for a while. My mother's new husband had a son, Scott, from a previous marriage who was 2 years older than me. Scott paid no attention to me in the beginning, but soon enough, as my body began to change and I grew into womanhood, he took another look. He was always walking in on me in the shower, claiming he didn't know I was there, or I would catch him watching me while I tanned by the pool. I tried to ignore him when I could. I kept the door to my room locked. Scott and I were at the house one night. I was 16. It was a rainy evening. My mother and his father were out at dinner. I was in the kitchen getting a soda from the refrigerator when he came up from behind and kissed me. I remember very clearly he said, It's okay. We're not really brother and sister, so it's fine. But it wasn't fine with me. I tried to push him off, but he was stronger than me. I wasn't a prude. I had kissed boys before. But this was not what I wanted. He came at me again. He knocked me to the floor and climbed on top of me. He did unspeakable things, all against my will. I don't know why, but he thought he could do whatever he wanted. That's how boys are. Later, I told my mother what he had done to me, but she didn't believe it. She accused me of trying to ruin things for her. She said, Look at this life they've given us. She warned me not to be ungrateful. Of course, I was only more upset after that, and I felt I couldn't stay there in such proximity to Scott. I knew it was only a matter of time before he came for me again. I told my mother I was moving out. She didn't fight it. She didn't offer to go with me. I don't think she had ever even wanted a child. She had me as a result of a one-night stand. I was less important than the things she had now. A nice house and diamond jewelry, an expensive car, and a big refrigerator. It was the life she had always dreamed of. We were even citizens now, and in the United States, no less. I went to a shelter and told them that I was on my own. I lied and said that my parents were both dead and that I had been fending for myself. I stayed with a girlfriend for a little while, too. I lived in her pool house for months, and her parents never even knew I was there. I missed my mother, but the truth was that I had missed her even when we were together, so it was nothing new. As soon as I got my high school diploma, I left California. The girlfriend I had stayed with was going to college in New Jersey. Her parents had given her a car for graduation, so she was going to fill it with her belongings and drive across the country to her new school. She offered to take me with her. I stayed with her in her dorm for a while until I found a job waiting tables and saved enough money to live on my own. I met a certain man while I had that job. He used to sit at the counter and order blueberry pie. He used to flirt with me sometimes. I tried to resist him. I was suspicious of men by then. I wanted nothing to do with them. But he was persistent, and he was kind, and he made me laugh. He started staying after the restaurant had closed, talking to me while I cleaned up. He used to walk me home when it was dark. He didn't know what he was getting into with me, though. He never did anything wrong, but it was a struggle for me to be truly close to him. It was difficult, because of my past, to trust him. I pushed him away. Every time he came back to me, I pushed again, until finally he left. But he's the father of my two boys, and I've gone out of my way to make sure that they turn out to be good and respectful. When they were in my house, they never laid a hand on a girl, never a kiss, nothing. I was very watchful. It's possible they're the only good boys in the world. With the help of scholarships and financial aid, they're able to attend university. They're studying hard there. Now I receive money every month as part of my divorce settlement. So financially, I'm secure. But I also choose to volunteer my time on Mondays and Wednesdays at the hospital because I feel I should do something positive with my time, something to help people. It's the least I can do. I have enough money that maybe I could live somewhere else, but my friends are here. Besides my boys, my friends are all I have. Almost no one in my life now knows what I've been through, nor do I want them to know. Some things should be private. That's what I always say. Besides, I don't need anyone's pity. My life has been what it has been. It's not a wonderful story, but it's mine.
Alma. The days that December were long and cold. We had been keeping our thermostat at 80 degrees, but then our first heating bill arrived in the amount of $304.52, which made me cry when I saw it, and made Arturo shred the paper into bits the size of confetti. Neither of us needed to say out loud that we couldn't pay it. We turned the heat down to 60 after that and huddled by the radiators for warmth. We wrapped blankets around our shoulders, pinching them closed in our fists, and wore extra pairs of socks. I tied a scarf over my head, even though Arturo said it made me look like a terrorist. The wind sliced through the edges of the old, loose windows and shuttled cold air into our bedroom. Arturo tried to smooth caulk into the crevices, but the caulk cracked when it dried. He taped rags around the window casings, but it was little help. "My body isn't made for this weather," I told Arturo, who laughed the first time I said it and frowned when I repeated myself again a few days later. "We shouldn't complain," he said.
so I did my best to focus on the positive. Maribel had laughed twice since that first time, and it seemed to me that she was able to remember more on her own now, too. She still relied on her notebook, but during Mass, for example, she knew when to kneel and when to stand, when to go up for communion, and how to find her way back to our seat afterwards. The reports from school were encouraging, too. The most recent one had said, Maribel speaks with increasing frequency, both to the teacher and to the aide, although only in Spanish. She has begun to respond to questions, although at times her response is inconsistent with the question asked. Both in voluntary speech and in reply, she has begun to modulate her voice to be more expressive. Even so, I was a worrier by nature, and I couldn't escape the feeling that anything could happen to her at any time. As if because something terrible had happened to her once, there was more of a possibility that something terrible would happen to her again. Or maybe it was merely that I understood how vulnerable she was in a way I hadn't before. I understood how easily and how quickly things could be snatched away. Every school morning, I stood outside and waited for the bus with her. Every afternoon, I met her again in the same spot. Maribel had developed a sort of friendship with Mayor Toro, which seemed like one more way that she was making progress. He was her first friend since the accident, but I told her that she and Mayor were only allowed to spend time together under supervision, either at our apartment or at the Torres's. About that, I was firm. The Torres's front door was no more than 10 meters from ours, down on the first floor, but I stood outside and watched Maribel walk the distance, waiting for her to go inside before I did. When it was time for her to come home, I watched for her again. I was making enchiladas de carne one day, with some near-expired brisket I found on clearance at the meat market. I was humming to myself a song my mother used to sing me when I was a girl. I washed the black pasilla chiles off my hands, patting them dry against my pants, and glimpsed the clock which read just past 5. My heart leapt. How had it gotten so late? Maribel should have been home by then. Quickly, I walked to the door and opened it, expecting to see her mounting the stairs walking toward me, but all I saw was the cracked asphalt and the faded white paint lines in the empty parking lot. Where was she? Was she still at the Torres's? I closed the door behind me, stepped outside, and started toward the Torres's apartment. When I got to the bottom of the staircase, I heard laughter. Not Maribel's, but someone's, coming from around the side of the building, and then I heard a boy's voice. I crept toward it. Maribel? I called. No one answered. Maribel! I said louder, inching my way forward. I kicked something and looked down to see Maribel's sunglasses on the ground. Unease rose beneath my breastbone. I picked up the sunglasses and kept walking, listening for her, but everything was quiet now. And then, as I turned the corner, I saw her. Her back was against the cinder block wall, and her hands were up over her head. A boy. The boy from the gas station. I recognized him instantly, was holding her wrists in place, staring at her. Her shirt was bunched under her armpits, exposing her white cotton bra, and her head was turned to the side, her eyes squeezed shut. I screamed. The boy startled and spun his head around. Get away from her, I yelled. I raced to wedge myself between them, yanking Maribel's shirt down, shielding her with my body. The boy said something in English, something unintelligible to me,
but I could hear the indignation in his tone, and without thinking, I turned and spat in his face. He grabbed my arm, digging his nails into my skin. "Go, Maribel," I shrieked. "Go to the apartment." But she didn't move. She was mute and immobile, a tree rooted in place. "Go," I said, tearing myself away from the boy, and then I ran, dragging Maribel with me to the front of the building, back up the staircase, and into the apartment, where I locked the door behind us, gasping and trying to blink away the blinding white light of panic. "What's wrong?" Arturo asked that night while we sat at the kitchen table. That ridiculous, stolen kitchen table, drinking manzanilla tea as we did most nights after Maribel went to bed. I looked at him, startled as if he had woken me from a dream. "What do you mean?"
"You're so quiet," he said.
"I was thinking."
"About what?" I hadn't told him what happened. I wasn't going to tell him. I didn't want him to know that I had failed Maribel again. Besides, she was okay. I had asked her what the boy had done, if he had kissed her, if he had touched her, if he had hurt her. And she shook her head no. He had pushed her against the wall. He was going to do something. That was clear. But I had gotten there in time. And when I inspected her, examining every visible part of her body, there were no scratches, no marks of any kind. "She's okay," I told myself with a certain strange relief. I tried to focus on that instead of on the other part of me that chimed. "This time."
"Alma," Arturo prodded. "I was thinking about Maribel," I said. It felt like a way of telling him the truth. At the sound of her name, he softened.
"She's doing better, no? The reports from school?"
"Yes."
"But you're worried," Arturo asked.
I attempted a smile. "No."
"You're worried about something."
I stared at him and shook my head lightly.
"Yes, you are. You worry about everything. You're a true Mexicana, a fatalist."
"As if you don't worry about things?"
"Of course. But I've been thinking. What if God wants us to be happy?
What if there's nothing else around the bend?
What if all our unhappiness is in the past, and from here on out we get an uncomplicated life? Some people get that, you know. Why shouldn't it be us?" I flattened my hand against the table, spreading my fingers out. It was a lovely thought. But hearing Arturo's optimism bubble to the surface, hearing the rawness of it was excruciating.
"You have to think like a gringa now," Arturo said. "You have to believe that you're entitled to happiness."
I took a small sip of tea, feeling the warmth of its bloom in my mouth. Outside, the wind howled and sent the tops of the leafless trees casting back and forth in the night. Soon it would be Christmas, and all at once I wished that we were back in Pátzcuaro, where Christmases were warm and thick with the scent of cinnamon, where piñatas filled with oranges and sugar canes hung from the rafters, and where children paraded through the streets carrying paper farolitos in their small hands. I wish we were anywhere but here. Geographically, emotionally. I wished our life was different, that it was what it used to be. 2 years ago, only 6 months before the accident, my parents had come over for Christmas Eve dinner, bringing Maribel a dress from Diseño y Artesanía that my mother insisted they wanted to give her. Maribel had made the buñuelos that year because At 14, she wanted to prove her independence and her capabilities. She first claimed she wanted to make the tamales and revoltijo de romeritos, but I argued they were too complicated. Besides, they were the main part of the meal. I thought, if they don't turn out, what will we eat? I told her. Maybe you can make the buñuelos. Buñuelos had what? Flour, sugar, salt, eggs, milk, butter, baking powder, cinnamon. No more, no less. How bad could they be? Early in the morning, she got out a bowl and fork. What are you doing? I asked. I'm making my buñuelos. Already? They don't take more than half an hour to prepare. I know. Do you also know that it's 8:30 in the morning? Yep. But we're not eating them until tonight. Mommy, she said, putting her hand on her hip. Maribel, I said, putting my hand on my hip the same way. She rolled her eyes. Come back around 6, I said, shooing her out of the kitchen. I'll be finished by then, and you can have the kitchen to yourself. At 6 on the dot, she came back and announced, Buñuelo time! I was wiping down the counter. My food was ready, heaped into bowls that I'd covered with foil and put in the refrigerator. Do you want my help? I asked. You told me I could make them. You can. I'm just asking if you want help. I knew the answer, though, when she pulled out a bowl, set it on the counter, and lined up her ingredients next to it. So you know where everything is? I asked before I left her alone. Mommy, she said, I live here. I've lived here all my life. That doesn't help your father, I said. Try asking him where anything is. Maribel dipped a finger in the sugar and licked it. Okay, I said. Call if you need anything. From the next room, I could hear her humming as she measured and poured and stirred. I heard drawers opening and closing and the clank of spoons against the inside of bowls. I heard the dough hit the counter and her little grunts as she kneaded it and rolled it out. I was sewing a button onto one of Arturo's work shirts when she walked out with flour on her chin. Are they done? I asked. She sat next to me and laid her flour hand on top of my knee. It's going well, she said solemnly, as if she were a doctor who had emerged from the operating room to deliver an update. She disappeared again, and I heard the crackle of the oil as it heated and the sighing sizzle as she dropped the flattened disks of dough in one by one. She's doing it, I thought. My girl. My parents came over for dinner that night, and we ate, flush with the merriment of the season. After everyone was finished, Maribel hurried into the kitchen where her buñuelos waited on an oval platter covered by a dish towel. She brought them out proudly, and like a perfect hostess, carried the plate around, holding it over each person's shoulder while they helped themselves to the desserts. The buñuelos were golden brown, and the cinnamon Maribel had sprinkled on the top of each while they were still warm had melted into the dough like tiny amber crystals. You made these? Arturo asked in disbelief. All by myself, Maribel said. Arturo looked at me. She did, I confirmed. They look wonderful, my mother said. And I saw Maribel looking over all of us, her face ripe with pride. I saw her growing up before me. I saw the family she would have one day. And the food she would make for them. I saw her entire life in front of her, waiting.
Mayor. I hadn't had a run-in with Garrett since I'd stood up to him that day with Maribel. I'd seen him around, hanging out alone behind the school, scratching at the sidewalk with a rock, flicking pebbles at the tires of the buses as they lined up to take everyone home. I'd seen him slouched in the hall, his hands in his coat pockets, staring at his scuffed boots. And I'd seen him during gym, even though he never got changed anymore. He showed up in his regular clothes, and Mr. Samuels would say, "You don't get dressed, you don't participate." And Garrett would shrug and plant himself on the wood bleachers and close his eyes for the next 45 minutes while we ran around shooting basketballs and learning badminton. Then one day, just before the winter break, I was digging a notebook out of my locker when I heard someone say, "How's Bird Brain?" I turned around. "How's your girlfriend?" Garrett asked. "Retard girl." "Don't call her that," I said. "What, girlfriend or retard?" "I told you to leave her alone," I said.
"You did?"
He screwed his face into an exaggerated look of confusion. I put the notebook in my backpack, shut my locker, and started walking.
"Hey,"
Garrett called. He trotted up beside me and grabbed my arm, yanking me so that I was facing him again.
"I was still talking to you."
"I need to go," I said, trying to pull my arm.